You're listening to The Out of the Crime. I'm Pooh.
And I'm William Cooper.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you, my dear, and good night.
Good night, and you're welcome.
Ladies and gentlemen, the world is full of crazy things. And I have to inform you that we have done some research into the so-called Viper Militia in Phoenix. And aside from what we have already given you, we have discovered that none of the things that the press has been telling you is included in any of the charges that are being levied against the so-called Viper Militia. Including the videotape that was supposed to show you how to blow up all the federal buildings in Phoenix, Arizona. You see, it seems that the government made all this up. And we are just now beginning to find out exactly why the government has made all this up. You see, Janet Napolitano, who is the United States attorney in the state of Arizona, is under fire and is under investigation in Congress. Seems that Miss Napolitano is struggling to get some brownie points. So she just made this whole thing up as a political thing. These guys are going to walk because they haven't done anything. They haven't done anything wrong. I doubt that they can get them on the slightest misdemeanor charge, but we'll find out. You see, people have been bringing child pornography charges against the people in the state of Arizona who are making child pornography, who are abusing children sexually, and who are making films using naked children in sexual acts to the United States Attorney, Janet Napolitano, to be prosecuted. She has never prosecuted any of them. She will not prosecute any child pornographers in the state of Arizona. And needless to say, the good citizens here are up in arms against her. Congress is investigating her. And she pulled off this Viper Militia stunt just to try to get some brownie points and make herself look good. Notice she was the one on camera. Instead of the so-called investigating officer. We also found out that there was no two-year investigation of these guys. That was all absolute bullshit. More propaganda dribble, or whatever you want to call it. Bad news. And I just found out what the echo was. I forgot to turn Pooh's mic off. So now the echo is gone. While I was telling you all of that, I was pushing buttons and looking around frantically to find out where that echo was coming from, and I finally realized I had Pooh's mic was still open. Now it's closed. So that's the story there. Also, the preliminary investigation by the intelligence service into the downing of the aircraft off the coast of New Jersey a few nights ago is turning up some incredible information. We're not ready to divulge any of it to you as yet, but if what we're beginning to discover is true, we may be looking at another Oklahoma City with that airplane. So, as soon as we have all the evidence and proof necessary to make a public disclosure, we will do so. If our investigation begins to point the other way, we'll also tell you that. But right now, it don't look good, folks. Doesn't look good at all. And I'm going to give you some background tonight as to exactly why and what it may mean for our collective futures, if there is such a thing. And if we agree that we're all Americans, then we must have a collective future. So don't go away. I'll be right back after this short pause. Give you some information now. This is taken from the Congressional Record of the Senate, 1916. And it was put on the record by Senator Owen. And here's how it reads. I wish to put in the record the secret treaty of Verona of November the 22nd, 1822, showing what this ancient conflict is between the rule of the few and the rule of the many. I wish to call the attention of the Senate to this treaty because it is the threat of this treaty which was the basis of the Monroe Doctrine. It throws a powerful white light upon the conflict between monarchical government and government by the people. The Holy Alliance, under the influence of Metternich, the Premier of Austria, in 1822, issued this remarkable secret document. From the American Diplomatic Code, 1778 to 1884, I quote, "The undersigned, specially authorized to make some additions to the Treaty of the Holy Alliance, after having exchanged their respective credentials, have agreed as follows. Article 1. The high contracting powers, being convinced that the system of representative government is equally as incompatible with the monarchical principles as the maxim of the sovereignty of the people with the divine right, engage mutually in the most solemn manner to use all their efforts to put an end to the system of representative governments in whatever country it may exist in Europe, and to prevent its being introduced in those countries where it is not yet known. Article 2. As it cannot be doubted that the liberty of the press is the most powerful means used by the pretended supporters of the rights of nations to the detriment of those of princes, the high contracting parties promise reciprocally to adopt all proper measures to suppress it, not only in their own states, but also in the rest of Europe. Article 3. Convinced that the principles of religion contribute most powerfully to keep nations in the state of passive obedience which they owe to their princes, the high contracting parties declare it to be their intention to sustain in their respective states those measures which the clergy may adopt with the aim of ameliorating their own interests, so intimately connected with the preservation of the authority of the princes, and the contracting powers join in offering their thanks to the Pope for what he has already done for them and solicit his constant cooperation in their views of submitting the nations. Article 4. The situation of Spain and Portugal unite unhappily all the circumstances to which this treaty has particular reference, the high contracting parties in confiding to France the care of putting an end to them engaged to assist her in the manner which may the least compromise them with their own people and the people of France by means of a subsidy on the part of the two empires of 20 million of francs every year from the date of the signature of this treaty to the end of the war. Article 5. In order to establish in the peninsula the order of things which existed before the revolution of Cadiz, and to ensure the entire execution of the articles of the present treaty, the high contracting parties give to each other the reciprocal assurance that as long as their views are not fulfilled, rejecting all other ideas of utility or other measure to be taken, they will address themselves with the shortest possible delay to all the authorities existing in their states and to all their agents in foreign countries with the view to establish connections tending toward the accomplishment of the objects proposed by this treaty. Article 6. This treaty shall be renewed with such changes as new circumstances may give occasion for, either at a new Congress or at the court of one of the contracting parties, as soon as the war with Spain shall be terminated. Article 7. The present treaty shall be ratified and the ratifications exchanged at Paris within the space of 6 months, made at Verona, the 22nd of November, 1822, for Austria, Metternich, for France, Chateaubriand, for Prussia, Bernstedt, for Russia, Nesselrode. And Mr. Owen states this in the Congressional Record. I ask to have printed in the Congressional Record this secret treaty because I think it ought to be called now to the attention of the people of the United States and of the world. This evidence of the conflict between the rule of the few versus popular government should be emphasized on the minds of the people of the United States, that the conflict now waging throughout the world may be more clearly understood. For after all said, the great pending war springs from the weakness and frailty of government by the few, where human error is far more probable than the error of the many, where aggressive war is only permitted upon the authorizing vote of those whose lives are jeopardized in the trenches of modern war. Mr. Shafroth, Mr. President, I should like to have the Senator state whether in that treaty there was not a coalition formed between the powerful countries of Europe to reestablish the sovereignty of Spain and the republics of South and Central America. Mr. Owen, I was just going to comment upon that, and I am going to take but a few moments to do so because I realize the pressure of other matters. This holy alliance, having put a Bourbon prince upon the throne of France by force, then used France to suppress the Constitution of Spain immediately afterwards, and by this very treaty gave her a subsidy of 20 million francs annually to enable her to wage war upon the people of Spain and prevent their exercise of any measure of the right of self-government. The Holy Alliance immediately did the same thing in Italy by sending Austrian troops to Italy, where the people there attempted to exercise like measure of liberal constitutional self-government. And it was not until the printing press, which the Holy Alliance so stoutly opposed, taught the people of Europe the value of liberty, that finally one country after another seized a greater and greater right of self-government, until now it may be fairly said that nearly all the nations of Europe have a very large measure of self-government. However, I wished to call the attention of the Senate and the country to this important history in the growth of constitutional popular self-government. The Holy Alliance made its powers felt by the wholesale drastic suppression of the press in Europe by universal censorship, by killing free speech and all ideas of popular rights, and by the complete suppression of popular government. The Holy Alliance, having destroyed popular government in Spain and in Italy, had well-laid plans also to destroy popular government in the American colonies, which had revolted from Spain and Portugal in Central and South America under the influence of the successful example of the United States. It was because of this conspiracy against the American republics by the European monarchies that the great English statesman, Canning, called the attention of our government to it and our statesmen then, including Thomas Jefferson, took an active part to bring about the declaration by President Monroe in his next annual message to the Congress of the United States, that the United States would regard it as an act of hostility to the government of the United States and an unfriendly act if this coalition, or if any power of Europe, ever undertook to establish upon the American continent any control of any American republic or to acquire any territorial rights. This is the so-called Monroe Doctrine, the threat under the secret treaty of Verona to suppress popular government in the American republics is the basis of the Monroe Doctrine. This secret treaty sets forth clearly the conflict between monarchical government and popular government, and the government of the few as against the government of the many. It is a part, in reality, of developing popular sovereignty when we demand for women equal rights to life, to liberty, to the possession of property, to an equal voice in the making of the laws and the administration of the laws. This demand on the part of the woman is made by men, and it ought to be made by men as well as by thinking progressive women, as it will promote human liberty and human happiness. I sympathize with it, and I hope that all parties will be in the national conventions give their approval to this larger measure of liberty to the better half of the human race. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that's the end of that. Anyone who believes that the monarchs, after being deposed, forgave, and forgot, is not playing with a full deck. Most of the monarchs, known as the black nobility collectively, belong to Freemasonry and to the secret fraternal orders. Most of these families are wealthy beyond your belief and may be more powerful today than when they sat upon thrones. Just because the secret treaty of Verona was signed in 1822 does not mean that the treaty is void. On the contrary, it is even more active today than it ever was in its history. It is imperative that you realize that privately the black nobility refused to ever recognize any government other than their own inherited and divine right to rule. They worked diligently behind the scenes to cause conditions whereby they might regain their crowns in a feudal system reigning over regions in a new world totalitarian socialist order. They believe that the United States rightfully belongs to England. Now, lest you believe that I jest, not too many years ago, the Monroe Doctrine was ruled null, void, and defunct, and was, in fact, done away with and is today ignored. Today, in most of the countries in South America, the Catholic Church sends its Jesuits priests to preach, teach, and subvert the lawful governments with the philosophy of liberation theology, which, simply put, ladies and gentlemen, they're teaching Marxist socialism to the poor people in all of the countries in South and Central America. And if you have noticed, Marxist socialism has taken a stranglehold upon the United States and threatens to destroy the last bastion of freedom upon the face of this earth. When our forefathers wrote the Constitution of these United States, they provided safeguards against despotism by providing a balance of power. The Constitution was set up to provide clear divisions of legislative, judicial, and executive powers. It was believed that this system would ensure that if one branch got out of hand, the other two would act to keep the one in check. This balance of power was predicated upon the assumption that none of the three branches could or would infringe upon the power of the others. The Constitution, ladies and gentlemen, is clear on the functions of each of the branches. The legislative will make the laws. The judicial will interpret the law. The executive will decide policy and enforce the law. This, of course, is the simplest of explanations, but this is not a textbook on government, nor is this a government class. My intent is to acquaint you with simple basics on the balance of power, so that you can then understand how it has been subverted. The legislature, which is Congress in the form of the House and Senate, is required to publish the laws that are made, and this is done in the Congressional Record and the Federal Register. Pending or past legislation can be obtained by citizens through their congressman or from the government printing office. Citizens cannot be held responsible for the law if it is not made available to them under our system of law. Ignorance is no excuse. Therefore, the law must be made available to all whenever anyone asks to see it or to have a copy. It is then paradoxical that the government body most representative of the American citizen is the one that has been the most easily subverted. Through PACs, payoffs, pork barrel politics, professional politicians, congressmen who are members of secret societies, and through greed and fear, our representatives and senators quit representing us a long, long time ago. Congress has tremendous powers, but fails in most cases to exercise even a token amount. Why is that, ladies and gentlemen? Well, it's because they gave most of the power away to the executive branch many, many years ago. How is it that our legislature has allowed and at times encouraged the executive branch to write law? You probably did not know that the president and others in the executive branch of the government can and do write law. This is done in the form of presidential executive orders, National Security Council memos, National Security Decision Directives, and National Security Directives. NSC memos, for short, were broad policy papers in the days after passage of the National Security Act. NSC memos, ladies and gentlemen, became narrower and more specific over the years, and the name has varied. It seems that when the public catches on to the name of one type of this subversion of the law, they simply change the name. And so when you request to see these directives and orders under the old name, they very simply tell you they do not exist, and they're telling you the truth, for the name has changed. Under Kennedy, they were called National Security Action Memorandums. President Bush has changed the name to National Security Directives. Recently, I heard the name National Security Decision Directive at a White House press conference under William Clinton. There's a tremendous difference between presidential executive orders, NSC memos, and National Security Decision Directives. Presidential executive orders, ladies and gentlemen, are listed in the Federal Register or presidential findings, which are made known to the House and Senate Intelligence Committees. The most important difference between the presidential executive orders and all of the others, no matter what they are called, is that the others do not have to be reported, reviewed, made available to anyone, and no one has to even acknowledge that they exist. And there is a peculiar distinction with the presidential executive orders, in that even though they're required to be listed and published in the Federal Register and the presidential findings, if they are classified under any of the various classifications under the National Security Act, they will not be listed, and their numbers will not be listed. The subject of the order will not be listed. And there is no oversight whatsoever, ladies and gentlemen, that could maintain a check on the legality of these national security directives. The president and others within the executive branch have used these super secret directives to skirt the balance of power and write law without anyone's knowledge. Justification of the president's power to write law through executive order stems from the failure of the government to rescind the declaration of martial law during the Civil War, when the first executive orders began to be written as law and placed into effect under military rule in the military districts and in the conquered South. In effect, the United States has been under martial law ever since Lincoln's administration. In fact, that is when the balance of power went askew. That was, in fact, ladies and gentlemen, when the Justice Department was created, when the United States Attorney General was created in order to administer martial law in the military districts and in the occupied Confederacy. You see, the Justice Department is an agency of martial law. It is not an agency and never has been an agency of the judicial branch of the United States government. It is an arm of the executive branch under the President of the United States. That is why a military flag fringed with gold flies in our courtrooms, both state and federal. The military districts were never abolished. Martial law was never ended after the Civil War. And in 1933, Congress voted, ladies and gentlemen, as part of the banking emergency, to approve all past, present, and future executive orders written by any president. Therefore, Congress stated when they passed that law on March the 9th, 1933, and gave Franklin Delano Roosevelt literally dictatorial powers, Congress stated that they had legislated dictatorial powers to the president and had literally turned over the legislative powers of the Congress, both House and Senate, to the president. This began during the Civil War, which continued after the Civil War all the way up to March 9th, 1933, and that's why they made the law retroactive and future covering. You see, the law approves any and all executive orders ever written in the past, in the present, at that time when the law was passed, or that any future president would ever write, and that these executive orders would indeed become law. So there is no more balance of power existing within the United States of America. There has not been since the Civil War. And the Banking Act of March 9, 1933, the Bank Emergency Act, legitimized all of it and created a dictatorship in the Oval Office of the White House. Of course, you must understand that the president is not a true dictator, for the president is placed there by very powerful and very wealthy people who have an agenda to serve. He fulfills their policy. The president never acts alone or of his own initiative. George Bush, William Clinton, and yes, Ronald Reagan, all the way back to the Civil War, every president has only been a puppet to the real power who put him there. These national security directives are powerful. They are hidden. They are very dangerous tools. They were prolific during the Reagan administration. Over 300 were written, with no more than 50 ever leaking out to undergo public scrutiny. Yet most Americans have never heard of these subversive weapons. They are being used to destroy our Constitution. I believe that everyone should know about this corruption of government. It's not much that you can do about it, short of a war, which will come. Not because I want it. I've done everything in the world that one man can possibly do to prevent war in this country. But I can see the writing on the wall. I can see that the more we try to save liberty and freedom, the more we try to restore constitutional Republican government, the more they do to subvert it and to destroy those of us who would protect it. Congress has turned a blind eye to these abuses of executive power, and they have turned a blind eye to their own responsibility, and in fact, are helping to fulfill the agenda of the hidden powers and bring about the New World totalitarian socialist state, under which we will all become slaves. Many of us already are. Thank you.
so betrayed and hurt. Who shall I say?
At 3:30 a.m. on Saturday, August 4th, 1990, the United States Senate made it even easier for the executive branch to subvert the Constitution and may have even made the president the first American king, and the first to enjoy that stature was George Bush. At that time, on that day, a minority of United States senators, maybe 10 at the most, passed Senate Intelligence Authorization Act for fiscal year 1991, known as SB 2834. This bill fundamentally changed our constitutional system and threatens to destroy the very foundations of our great nation. Since attention was focused at that time upon the Middle East crisis, the public and most congressmen knew absolutely nothing about the bill. It was fraudulently introduced as a reform to prevent future incidents of the abuses brought to light during the Iran-Contra scandal. Instead of preventing future abuses, however, it virtually authorized essentially every abuse. The bill was carefully brought to a vote by Senator Sam Nunn in the dead of night when the opposition was gone. It effectively transferred most authority over the United States government directly into the hands of the president and thus directly into the hands of the secret government. Bob Dole was one of the ones responsible for this vote. The president, at that time George Bush, was given the power to initiate war without permission of Congress, without a vote of Congress, without consulting Congress or the people. He was given the power to appropriate public funds, define foreign policy goals, and decide what is important to our national security. In oversight of intelligence activities, Title VII, SB 2834, authorized the following. It gave the president power to initiate covert actions. And this has never before been given to the president until that time. It prevents Congress from stopping the president's initiation of covert actions, allows the president to use any, I repeat, any federal departments, agencies, or entities to operate or finance a covert operation. It empowers the president to use any other nation or private contractor or person to fund or operate a covert action. It redefines covert actions as operations, quote, necessary to support foreign policy objectives of the United States, end quote. This is a definition that is so vague and broad as to be essentially unlimited. For the first time, officially, it claims the right of the United States to secretly interfere in the internal, political, economic, or military affairs or of other countries in direct and flagrant violation of international law. It requires that the president prepare and deliver a written finding to the intelligence committees of the Congress, but allows the president to omit extremely sensitive matters and authorizes the president to claim executive privilege if Congress asks too many questions. Do you understand what it is that I am telling you, ladies and gentlemen? You see, there are no penalties in the bill for violating any of its provisions, including the provision requiring a finding
Why should there be? This bill has literally handed the power of all the branches of government to the president on a silver platter, officially. President Bush was then, and William Clinton is now, truly American King Clinton the First. SB 2834 gives the president the power to use any agency or branch of the government and any appropriated funds from any agency or branch of the government for covert action, even if they were never appropriated for that purpose. The bill effectively prevents any oversight by anyone and allows the executive branch to skirt the law and to escape accountability, including covert actions within the United States of America against the American people. This is done using national security directives. A few examples of some past national security directives that have come to light will help you understand the seriousness of the matter. NSDD 84, entitled Safeguarding National Security Information. It was written on March the 11th, 1983. It was declassified in full. Subject: this directive drastically expands restrictions on government employees' freedom of speech. Those with access to classified information were required to sign a non-disclosure agreement. Those with access to a special category of classified information were made to agree to pre-publication review of any future writings. The use of polygraphs was authorized, even though polygraphs have been ruled by all courts to be unreliable and are not admissible in a court of law as evidence. The purpose was to prevent disclosure of information that could damage national security. The consequences? Well, the polygraph requirement was rescinded due to congressional opposition. Secrecy restrictions were imposed on more than 4 million government employees and contractors for more than 50 executive agencies. Many reporters' contacts were shut down. Government employees, unions, and members of Congress sued to protect the rights of whistleblowers, and the Supreme Court sent the case back to the district level for review without ruling on it. NSDD 84 indicated that several prominent people, including John Lear, Robert Lazar, Bruce Maccabee, Stanton Friedman, Clifford Stone, and many others, may be active government agents. They were all working in government jobs or for government contractors, and all of them were subject to this executive order. NSDD 84 was not used to silence them, which was used to silence and persecute many others who talked about much less sensitive subjects, and this seems to indicate that they had executive approval in each and every instance. NSDD 17, deterring Cuban models, covert action in Nicaragua, November the 23rd, 1981, classified. The subject: the Central Intelligence Agency was given authority to create the Contras and work with foreign governments as appropriate to undermine the Sandinista government of Nicaragua. The purpose was to stop the flow of arms from Cuban and Nicaraguan sources to the Salvadorian rebels. The consequences? The Central Intelligence Agency was given $19 million to assemble and arm a force of 500 Contras to join with 1,000 exiles already being trained in Argentina. Scores of operatives arrived in Honduras. Armed shipments from Miami began. The Contra War was set in motion. NSDD 77, Management of Public Diplomacy Relative to National Security, January 14, 1983, declassified in full. Subject: this directive set up several planning groups to conduct public diplomacy activities. Listen carefully to me. It ordered organizational support for foreign governments and private groups to encourage the growth of democratic political institutions and practices, read Marxism. The purpose was to mobilize international and domestic support for, quote, our national security objectives, end quote. The consequences? It created propaganda ministries in the National Security Council, the State Department, and the White House that concentrated on, in the words of the NSC staff member in charge of the program, quote, gluing black hats on the Sandinistas and white hats on UNO, end quote, the Contras' United Nicaraguan Opposition. Stories were planted in the press. Journalists were pressured. The General Accounting Office later found that these activities violated the law, banning covert propaganda inside the United States. Yet nothing was done about it. The propaganda continues and is even worse than ever before today. And now we know that many, many journalists are on the active payroll of the Central Intelligence Agency. How many other covert propaganda programs do you think are operating against the American citizens? I can assure you that there are many more than you would ever believe. Many more than you have even caught on to. NSDD 138, International Terrorism, pay particular attention to this. April 3rd, 1984, it is still classified. Subject, this directive endorsed the principle of preemptive strikes and retaliatory raids against terrorists and called on 26 federal agencies to recommend specific measures to combat terrorism. The purpose is to lessen international terrorism and free United States hostages in Lebanon, or so it's stated. While this NSD directive pretends to be concerned about international terrorism, it is really a thinly disguised authorization of preemptive strikes and retaliatory raids against patriots in this country. When FEMA is activated, patriots will be rounded up in the dead of night, most likely on a national holiday such as Thanksgiving or Christmas or the 4th of July. Government agents and law enforcement officers in every city across the nation have received anti-terrorist training under this NSDD directive, and I can assure you the target is patriots. The consequences: set up the Terrorist Incident Working Group under North in the NSC. Its first major action was the interception and capture of the Arkeely LaRue hijackers, which gave North's career an important boost. Either NSDD 138 or a subsequent NSD directive on terrorism authorized the training of three Lebanese units for preemptive strikes, and when problems arose, Director of Central Intelligence William Casey took that operation off the books and enlisted Saudi Arabian help in an attempt to assassinate the head of Hezbollah. A resulting car bombing killed about 80 in Beirut. Sheikh Fadlallah, the target, was unhurt. The United States military, along with civilian law enforcement teams, conducted joint anti-terrorist training across America. To allay public fears, the participants wore civilian clothing. Most of the terrorist organizations in the world today were funded and trained by the Central Intelligence Agency during the reign of William Casey. NSD directives have become the de facto legislative vehicle of the national security state. It has become known through the research of Susan Fitzgerald, a research consultant at the Fund for Constitutional Government in Washington, who has collected declassified NSD directives, that many were released without the White House letterhead at the top of the page and without the president's signature at the bottom. The true author and originator of these NSDs are unknown. This, she speculates, is to conceal the fact that the signatures on some of them would reveal that they had been made by auto pen and not by the president's own hand. That should give you a taste, ladies and gentlemen, of what we are up against. Please understand that virtually all, but a very few NSD directives still remain classified, and unless the public forces disclosure, their effect will probably never be known until it is too late. Somewhere within the volumes of secret NSD directives, there is a plan to suspend the Constitution of the United States of America. The existence of this plan surfaced during the Iran-Contra hearings. Congressman Jack Brooks, Democrat of Texas, attempting to bring it into the open. When he asked Colonel North directly if North had ever helped draft a plan to suspend the Constitution, Brooks was silenced by the committee chairman, Senator Daniel K. Inouye, Democrat of Hawaii. Senator Inouye stated that the subject dealt with national security, and any questions regarding the matter could be brought up during a closed-door session or not at all. We never learned the outcome. I would like to know who gave anyone in any branch of government with any title the right to suspend the Constitution at any time for any reason under any conditions. The document, which is the supreme law of the land, does not provide in itself at any place whatsoever any conditions or any authority to any branch or any person to suspend the Constitution for any reason. The only part of the Constitution which the Constitution itself gives allowances for suspension of is habeas corpus under time of war. I believe the plan to suspend the Constitution is directly tied to the underground facility called Mount Weather and to the Federal Emergency Management Agency, which is known as FEMA. Mount Weather is so shrouded in secrecy that 99% of Americans have never heard of it. FEMA, however, is another story. Remember Hurricane Hugo? Remember the federal agency FEMA that was sent to handle the emergency and was thrown out by the citizens because of gross incompetence? FEMA was incompetent because emergency management is just a guise for its real purpose, which is to take over local, state, and federal government in case of a national emergency. The only way FEMA could do such a thing is if the Constitution were suspended and martial law were to be declared. Therefore, its very existence is proof positive that a plan to suspend the Constitution does, in fact, exist. Mount Weather is a facility, ladies and gentlemen, that exists underground, just outside of a sleepy little town called Bluemont, Virginia. About 46 miles west of Washington, D.C., is an area of wilderness covering what has been called the toughest granite rock in the eastern United States. This area is surrounded by signs marked restricted area, and this installation has been declared a restricted area. Unauthorized entry is prohibited. Other signs state, all persons and vehicles entering hereon are liable to search. Photographing, making notes, drawings, maps, or graphic representations of this area or its activities is prohibited. Such material found in the possession of unauthorized persons will be confiscated. Internal Security Act of 1950, end quote. The installation is beneath a mountain, and its name is the Western Virginia Office of Controlled Conflict Operations. Notice I said controlled conflict operations, which means that conflicts initiated will be controlled, both sides, from this installation. Let me read it to you again. The Western Virginia Office of Controlled Conflict Operations. Its nickname is Mount Weather. It was ordered to be built by the Federal Civil Defense Administration, which is now the Federal Preparedness Agency. Mount Weather was designed in the early 50s as part of a civil defense program to house and protect the executive branch of the federal government. The official name was, quote, the Continuity of Government Program, end quote. That program no longer exists, but Mount Weather is still there. Congress has repeatedly tried to discover the real purpose of Mount Weather, but so far has been unable to find out anything about the secret installation. Retired Air Force General Leslie W. Bray, director of the Federal Preparedness Agency, told the Senate Subcommittee on Constitutional Rights in September 1975, quote, I am not at liberty to describe precisely what is the role and the mission and the capability that we have at Mount Weather or at any other precise location, end quote. In June 1975, Senator John Tunney, Democrat, California, chairman of the Subcommittee on Constitutional Rights, charged that Mount Weather held dossiers on at least 100,000 Americans. He later alleged that the Mount Weather computers, described as the best in the world, can obtain millions of pieces of additional information on the personal lives of American citizens simply by tapping the data stored at any of the other 96 federal relocation centers. I know from my stint, ladies and gentlemen, with the Office of Naval Intelligence, that these dossiers consist of information collected about American patriots, men and women who are most likely to resist the destruction of our Constitution and the formation of the totalitarian police state under the New World Order. The Patriot Data Bank is constantly updated so that when the appointed hour arrives, all patriots can be rounded up with little, if any, effort. The plan calls for this to be accomplished in the dead of night on a national holiday. those appointed the task of identifying patriot leaders and patriots who will resist the New World Order are under Operation Trojan Horse. The most likely holiday that this will occur is Thanksgiving, when everyone, no matter the religion, race, or creed, will be at home. But it could occur on Christmas, New Year's, the 4th of July. The targets will be ripe for the picking after a heavy meal, maybe some alcoholic beverages, and during a deep, deep sleep. There is a traitor amongst you. Collectively, there are many traitors amongst us, but almost every major patriot organization in this country has been infiltrated. They provide the secret government with accurate names and addresses of patriots who will fight to protect and defend the Constitution for the United States of America. My recommendation is that no patriot should ever be at home or at the home of any family member on any holiday ever again until the traitors have been hung and the Constitution restored as the supreme law of this land. Some sources state that Mount Weather is virtually an underground city complete with dormitories, private apartments, streets, sidewalks, cafeterias, hospitals, water purification systems, power plant, office buildings, a lake fed by fresh water from underground springs, a mass transit system, and many other astounding things. Several disturbing facts emerge when one researches Mount Weather. One is the conclusion that a complete parallel government exists at the site. 9 federal departments exist there: agriculture, commerce, HEW, HUD, interior, labor, state, transportation, and the treasury. Apparently, at least 5 federal agencies are also in residence: FCC, Selective Service, Federal Power Commission, Civil Service Commission, and the Veterans Administration. 2 privately owned corporations have offices at Mount Weather: the Federal Reserve and the U.S. Post Office. There is also an office of the presidency. What makes all this upsetting, ladies and gentlemen, is that there is a president and a complete set of cabinet officers in residence at Mount Weather. Who are they? And who appointed them? Who elected these people? Where is such a thing provided for in the Constitution for the United States of America? You see, Mount Weather is the operational center, the hub, of over 96 other underground federal relocation centers scattered across the United States. The majority of these appear to be concentrated in Pennsylvania, Virginia, West Virginia, Maryland, and North Carolina. Each of these facilities contains computer databanks holding information not on enemy agents, ladies and gentlemen, not on Soviet diplomats or suspected terrorists, but on American citizens, patriots. A list of other files kept at the facilities was furnished to the Subcommittee on Constitutional Rights in 1975. The list included military installations, government facilities, communications, transportation, energy and power, agriculture, manufacturing, wholesale and retail services, manpower, financial, medical and educational institutions, sanitary facilities, population, housing, shelter, and stockpiles. The committee concluded that these databases operate with few, if any, safeguards or guidelines. Senator James Aborzek, Democrat, South Dakota, a member of the subcommittee, said, "I feel the entire operation has eluded the supervision of either Congress or the courts." Chairman Tunney said, "Mount Weather is out of control. Nothing was done by Congress to rectify the situation, however, and Mount Weather remains out of control." Former high-level officials from Mount Weather agree that the base at Mount Weather is much, much more than any standby government facility or storage center for the preservation of records. They describe it as an actual government in waiting. Quote, "We do not merely store essential information. The facility attempts to duplicate the vital functions of the executive branch of the administration," end quote. As stated above, according to my research, this includes a president and all cabinet members actually in residence. Protocol even demands that subordinates address them as Mr. President or Mr. Secretary. Most of these mysterious appointees have held their positions through several administrations. "We just act on the orders of the president in national emergencies," said one former Mount Weather official. The FPA, in its 1974 annual report, stated that studies conducted at Mount Weather involved the control and management of domestic political unrest where there are material shortages such as food riots or in strike situations where the FPA determines that there are industrial disruptions and other domestic resource crises. The report states that the bureaucracy at Mount Weather invokes what it calls, quote, civil crisis management, end quote. Officials who were at Mount Weather and who have furnished us with data say that during the 1960s, the complex was actually prepared to assume certain governmental powers at the time of the 1961 Cuban Missile Crisis and the assassination of President Kennedy in 1963. The source said that the installation used the tools of its civil crisis management program on a standby basis during the 1967 and 68 urban riots and during a number of national anti-war demonstrations against the administration by the American people. Daniel J. Cronin, who was the assistant director for the FPA, outlined a massive surveillance and manipulation program that is directed against the American population on a continuing basis. The FPA has organized an impressive armament of resources and equipment. Mr. Cronin described in an interview his agency's attitude toward its wide-ranging surveillance program. We try to monitor situations, he said, and get to them before they become emergencies. No expense is spared in the monitoring program. He cited reconnaissance satellites, local and state police intelligence reports, and law enforcement agencies of the federal government as examples of the resources available to the FPA for information gathering. And there is much, much more. Nixon's executive order sort of spells it out. It says, whereas national preparedness must be achieved as may be required to deal with increases in international tension with limited war or with general war, including attack upon the United States. Later it was changed to say, under Nixon, whereas our national security is dependent upon our ability to assure continuity of government at every level in any national emergency type situation that might conceivably confront the nation. He deleted the reference to war. He deleted the reference to imminent attack and general war, and from the order and replaced them with the phrase, during any emergency that might conceivably occur. Senator Tunney, in 1975, expressed concern. We know from what we've heard in the press that 15,000 names were being maintained by the FBI for detention in an emergency. We also know that the IRS had its files on individual taxpayers. We know the CIA had their Operation Chaos and that the NSA has the records of conversations that have been intercepted electronically. My question is this. Is there anyone like yourself, General Bray, that is in control of the overall access to this data if it is maintained in a relocation site? And your answer, as I understood it, is no, Tunney continued. General Bray, I must say that I still don't know who's in control of these relocation centers. You say you don't have that knowledge, and still we don't know from the three witnesses that we had here today that they had information as to who has control of these centers. General Bray answered, I am not at liberty to describe precisely what is the role in the mission and the capability that we have at Mount Weather or at any other precise location. Ladies and gentlemen, what you have heard tonight in its entirety is from my book, Behold a Pale Horse, written 6 years ago. Good night, ladies and gentlemen. And God bless each and every single one of you.
till I'm gathered safely. Lift me like an olive branch, be my home.